Talk Radio 790 KBC. Peter Till the 10 continues. Hour number two brought to you by Larry Miller and Sit and Sleep. Of course, it'll be anyone's advertised price. Your mattress is free. Coming up, Kenny Rogers. Over 100 million albums sold. One of the most successful performers of all times. We got tickets to see him. It's the Gambler's last deal at the Pacific Amphitheater. Or Ann Wilson of Heart. When I tell you to call, we'll play the news quiz. Lots of other stories to talk to and you to get to. 800-222-5222 is the phone number if you want to participate. And I'd love you to. Josh Dawsey, White House correspondent for Politico, joins us now. Josh, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm always good when I get to talk to you. What's it like there with the press briefings? I saw that Sean Spicer, it's been reported he's looking for his own replacement, and I'm guessing if that's true, he's probably looking under every rock to get it to happen quick enough. Couldn't be quick enough for him. That's number one. Number two, I saw that the president's thinking about maybe redoing the press briefings and maybe once a week and only with pre-sorted questions where you give them questions ahead of time so they can see what they are.
Right.
What is the press? And you're
I don't
right
think
to,
that will ever happen. I mean, I do think that is folks in the White House have mused about that, and the president has, you know, he even publicly tweeted that maybe we should hand out written responses for accuracy. But, you know, I think there would be a full-scale rebellion if there was a once-a-week briefing where the questions were screened. I mean, what is that? Like communism? I mean, what are we doing here? You know, I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, we'll see, but I don't think that's going to happen. Sean is definitely looking for his replacement. But, you know, I think you're right. I mean, I think from my sense, I mean, he's exasperated. This has been a rough few months, and, you know, good luck to the next person doing this job better than him. I don't know that anyone could.
And they don't have anybody.
I'm not saying that I think he's done a great job. I'm just saying I don't know that anyone could do it better.
No, it's really tough. And so who's lined up? Who even is in the mix right now?
Well, you know, they've talked to a whole hodgepodge of people. They've talked to Laura Ingraham. They've talked to Jason Miller, who was a campaign spokesman. They've talked to Kim Guilfoyle, who was a Fox News host. She's not going to do it. I don't think Laura Ingraham's going to do it. I mean, it's a pretty fascinating thing, actually, that, you know, you have what was once seen as one of the most prestigious jobs in American, you know, politics. You know, you get to be the press secretary to the president of the United States, and now you have, you know, not a whole host of people knocking down the door to get in there, needless to say.
And Sarah Huckabee Sanders not saying, ooh, ooh, me?
Well, I've heard mixed things there. I've heard from some folks in the White House that she's interested. I've heard from others that she's not. You know, I think it's really hard to know. I think in some ways she's trying to, you know, keep her head down right now because, you know, one of the ways in this White House that I've seen you get your head chopped off is if you raise your hand too high and people begin to see you as a threat, and then, you know, it's not good for you.
Keep it on down low. Before we move from that, because people don't get that experience of the press room, you're in there all the time, raising your hand, getting called on.
Right.
What don't we get to see? At first of all, it's a very small room, smaller than, I guess, because I saw it once and I was shocked at how tiny it is. But the second part is, what don't we get to see as far as the positioning and getting to answer a question or your relationship or everybody's relationship with Sean Spicer? What goes on that we wouldn't know?
Well, I mean, I think the dynamic that you say is right. I mean, it's a very small room, and, you know, the quarters back where the press works, I mean, we have two desks in there. Most outlets have, you know, one desk, two desks, three desks, you know, based on the size of the outlet. You know, it's pretty Spartan. I mean, it's not like, you know, a nice, luxurious place to work, as you might imagine, watching, you know, the West Wing on television. You know, there are actually some nice coffee machines now because, Tom Hanks and some other folks, who are wealthy sent espresso machines and nice machines back to the press room, after the Trump presidency has started. And there's been kind of this daily proverbial war on TV. But, it's not this luxurious place that you might imagine. And I mean, you walk up from the press room and you go back behind, you know, the door where Sean Spicer walks out, and you're maybe, you know, 25 steps from his office. And then you're maybe, you know, 25 or 30 steps from there is the Oval Office.
You're right there. It's right there.
You know, the West Wing is a like pretty small. I'm not saying you can get there. I mean, I can't just, you know, go into the West Wing and knock on the door and say hello. But, you know, you're in really close proximity to it all.
And do you ever talk to Sean afterwards if he's dissing you or didn't call on you? Did you get a chance to hang with him later and go, what's the deal? And it's a different relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I talk to Sean almost every day. I haven't talked to him in a few days now, and I was just telling a colleague that. But I talk to Sean all the time, you know. You know, at 10:30 p.m. when he's driving home from work, or early in the morning, or, you know, you just walk up to his office and knock on the door, and if he's you know, not too busy, he'll let you come in for a second, and, you know, but he has a tough job. I mean, he's dealing with, you know, thousands of TV outlets, print outlets. You know, he is not someone who has an inordinate amount of time on his hands.
Well, you just said the one thing that gave us some insight, too. 10:30 at night when he's driving home from work.
Right.
So that kind of tells you what his day is. It's 7 in the morning until whenever, right?
Right. Sure.
Pretty.
And then you might get home at 11:30 and the president, you know, may see something on TV and call you and, you know, berate you then. I mean, it's not,
and you're
not
in the bushes.
Easy situation.
And you're in the bushes. Let's talk for a moment about the Russian election interference, because this morning there was a committee that met, the Senate committee, investigating Russian hacking. And again, we're hearing, no question about it, that Putin definitely attacked our election. And as a matter of fact, they pinned it down to potentially target as many as 21 states' election systems. They're saying they didn't get in, but it felt like, I guess the explanation they used was like rattling the doorknob to see if the door was open, if I'm not incorrect. So what is that going to accomplish now? Yet again, they're saying unequivocally, Russia attacked us. It was widespread. We know it's them.
Well,
what happens now?
I think at this point, it's a bit of a silly argument on whether they did or not. I mean, 16 different intelligence agencies have said this. I mean, I think basically everyone on both sides of the aisle on Capitol Hill, you know, senators, representatives, you know, intelligence officials, I mean, everyone has publicly said this, basically, except for the president. And I, you know, think, from what I can gather, the president doesn't want to admit this because he thinks it's delegitimizing his victory. Sorry, I mispronounced that. But, you know, taking away legitimacy from his victory. But it's an undisputed fact. I mean, I mean, I don't want to say anything's an undisputed fact because, you know, you could be hoodwinked by, I guess, 16 different intelligence agencies. And, you know, there's always a conspiracy that could happen. But it's a pretty much an undisputed fact among everyone in Washington that this happened, except for the president. You know, you saw yesterday Sean's spy survey. He was asked, you know, does the president believe the Russians attacked the election? He said, oh, I've not had that conversation with them, which was kind of an interesting dodge.
But it continues.
What you keep hearing on Capitol Hill from, you know, intelligence officials, from Comey, who testified, from Jay Johnson, from Dan Coats, from others, is, you know, they're going to do this again. I mean, they are doing this in free and fair elections, at least it's free and fair around the world. I mean, they want to disrupt democracy. They do not want, you know, the United States to have a free and fair election, no matter if it's Trump or, you know, in 4 years or 8 years or 16 years. I mean, I just think it's going to be something, you know, that's going to continue. I mean, they do not like the fact how our elections are done. I mean, they want to sow discord. You know, it's a way of having power.
But Congress is obviously taking it drop-dead seriously, both sides of the aisle. The investigations continue, and the intel community is continuing to operate as if it's true and pushing back and trying to protect us. It's everybody's taking it very seriously, correct?
Sure. Yeah,
all right. 100%. All right. So in D.C., these investigations keep going on. And in D.C., what does it feel like today? It's funny, the Democrats, well, watching that election, and I talked about it last hour in Georgia, it's funny, the Democrats, it's a referendum on Trump. Unless you lose, then it's not a referendum. But I got to tell you, my take on this was Ossoff didn't have much of a campaign. The messaging, what's the messaging?
Sure.
You got a country that just went through an election. The Democrats watched what happened. They must know that the country cares about the economy, about illegal immigration,
right,
about North Korea, about taxes, about Iran. And what do? Ossoff gets up there and says, I want fresh leadership, great quality of life, and we got to have bipartisan actions. And like my mother would say, he's a nice young man. Obviously not enough when you're spending
right.
that kind of money to make inroads
right.
there, because the woman he ran against, Handel, is not somebody who is unbeatable. The Democrats have to be looking at themselves and saying, maybe we should rethink Nancy Pelosi at this point. Maybe we should have a slogan. Maybe we should have something that generates excitement.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that, you know, it showed in that race that, you know, Karen Handel ran pretty hard against Pelosi. And I think, you know, Pelosi is not a popular figure in much of the country, particularly in a suburban Georgia district. I mean, listen, here's the thing. Here's the way I see it, at least. You know, you had Republicans won in Montana. That was to be pretty much expected. Even after, you know, the Greg Gianforte guy, you know, body slammed the reporter and now pled guilty to misdemeanor assault. You know, the one in South Carolina. They won in Georgia yesterday. I'm missing one state, but there's been four since January 20th, and Republicans won on four.
In South Carolina.
What'd you say?
South Carolina?
South Carolina, you know, Georgia, Montana, and I'm missing one.
Yeah, I'm blanking on the fourth also.
Right.
They're over four.
But, you know, here's what I think we have to be careful of. I don't think there's, you know, necessarily widespread ramifications of this. I mean, all four of these districts, and I went back and kind of looked at some point when I remembered the fourth I did this, but all four are pretty reliably Republican districts. I mean, if you look at, you know, Mitt Romney won the Georgia district where Karen Handel won by, you know, double digits. Montana is about as Republican as it gets. You know, these are not places that Democrats have done historically well. You know, that said, you know, Democrats have made a lot of hay about, you know, President Trump's historic unpopularity and, you know, all of his problems, and that's true. I mean, you do have a president whose numbers are below 40%, but I think in a lot of ways, you know, People are voting about local issues. They're voting, like you said, you know, about their taxes. They're voting about security and their what they see as security in their communities. They're voting, you know, you look at these exit polls. They're voting more about, you know, what's happening there than kind of the clamor and turmoil in Washington. And, you know, in these Republican districts, I think it's going to be harder for Democrats to take these, you know, to turn these.
You can say, 100%.
Oh, the president's unpopular, okay. But if someone says, okay, are you going to raise or lower my taxes? You know, I think that probably care more about that than
you're exactly right. And by the way, I said he was so vanilla. I mean, I watched him. I wasn't blown away by the guy.
Right.
He got about the same a portion of the vote as Hillary did, about 48% that she did. But what amazes me is the Democrats, knowing all of this and knowing it's, yes, the win would have been hurtful to the Democrats because it was a district that they shouldn't have lost. And and they could have had bragging rights on the left. The Democrats would have been a big PR win for them. But do you really run a candidate who's got not much to say to the issues we just talked about and yet spend $20 million to promote that he's got not a whole lot to say? Let's spend a blank load of money to promote what? What's the message?
And you know, one of the most scathing attacks, I think, on him was that, you know, he didn't even live in the district. I mean, he was not even a resident of the district that he wanted to represent. And I think the, you know, Republicans were pretty effective in pointing that out to voters.
Absolutely. And both of them,
who's young, like you said. Yeah. Doesn't have a lot of experience, you know, doesn't necessarily have a coherent message, and doesn't live in the district. I mean,
what a win.
It's not the most compelling candidate.
We just summed it up. So if you're sitting back and you're the Democratic Party, this shows you the disarray they're in. They just did a Hail Mary. They said, we're going to spend a ton of money to promote, not a whole lot, and then we'll be really depressed when we lose. But they set themselves up for lose, and now the party has to decide which way they're going for 2018. Are they going to follow Bernie Sanders and become more progressive? Are they going to become more moderate down the center? Who is the party? What does it look like? What does it feel like? Because I think they're going to guess wrong again. And what they're going to try and do and what they're counting on is going to be in 2018 in the midterms, the health care. They're going to slam. Look what they did. Look what the Republicans did on health care and hope that that's going to be enough to convert people. And let's talk about health care.
I just want to make one point there, Peter. I mean, I think, you know, 2018 is so far away. You know, you might have a president who is down to the 20s in the polls, or he could be up around 50% in the polls by then. I mean, who knows? You know, if they get tax reform done, like the president of the White House wants to do this year, if they do get health care done and it turns the final product, turns into be something that, you know, does not necessarily hurt 25 million people like the House bill, you know, supposedly was going to, you know, if he gets the infrastructure done and, you know, this thing's going on, and if some of this Russia stuff dissipates or if it heightens. I mean, I just think, you know, I saw a lot of watching TV this morning, a lot of folks making, you know, these sweeping conclusions about what this means for 2018. I just don't think that's very smart because, A, it's so far away, and, B, I don't think we know.
100% we don't know, but I'm hoping that maybe they're smart enough to see that health care isn't just the slam they're going to get, and that the Republicans realize they got to do a good job. That said, with a minute and a half left, what are you hearing about health care? They're going to unveil it tomorrow, and there are a lot of Republicans, John McCain, who's saying he's not happy. I think he took a shot and said, I haven't seen what it looks like. Maybe the Russians probably have it. They probably hacked it and have it by now. What is going to happen with health care? Because they're trying to shove it through before the recess. And again, many in their own party have no idea what's in there.
Right. Well, we have not seen the bill. I mean, I think there, based on my sourcing, there are folks in the White House, senior folks in the White House, who have not seen the bill yet. You know, here's what's going to happen. There's going to be, the bill's going to be unveiled tomorrow. Supposedly, there's going to be a score from the Congressional Budget Office on Friday that will say, you know, here's how much money it could save, here's how many people could stand to lose insurance, you know, here will be the repercussions on the markets and policies, you know, how much it'll cost and deductibles, and we'll see all of that on Friday. And then Mitch McConnell is saying he wants a vote by next Thursday. You know, I think you have, right now, from what I can tell, they don't have the votes. But that doesn't mean they won't get the votes. You know, I think they're in the upper 40s, and then you have a lot of the problem they have, though, the problem that McConnell has is you have moderates, you know, like Lisa Murkowski of Maine and, of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine and, you know, who want, the bill to be more generous. And then you have hardliners, you know, of Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, and you have Rand Paul, who kind of is on his own little world. You know, it's hard to get the dynamics, because if you move the bill, you know, you make the Medicaid expansion, you know, less of a rollback, then you get the moderates and the conservatives balk. You know, so they just have a delicate, path here.
Absolutely.
If you
right.
do X and, you know, you make somebody mad, if you do Y, you make somebody else mad.
You also have Sean Spicer, who said yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, that the president wants it to have more heart. So obviously he was bothered.
What does that mean, though?
Well, my sense is he was bothered by what he heard as the pushback on
right.
the House bill. That it really bothered him when he right. heard some of the specifics, and it was concerning to him because they celebrated in the Rose Garden, and then afterwards said a couple weeks later that he wasn't basically, and I'm quote, happy with the bill. Like you said, have more heart. So I'm guessing that means more people
right.
covered. I'm guessing that means policies
right.
that are cheaper. I'm guessing pre-existing conditions, all of that.
Right, but one of the frustrating things that I keep hearing from the Hill is, you know, the president said last week that he thought the House bill was quote-unquote mean. You know, this was the same bill that he celebrated in the Rose Garden, you know, with all the members and said how great it was. You know, he told these folks he wants it to have more heart, and I understand that. And I think your analysis of that situation is correct. I think he's stung by, you know, all the stories and the TV coverage he's watched saying it will lose health care. But, you know, it's hard for them to make policy positions where the president says, you know, we need to do whatever it takes to get this passed. And it's basically what he told the House. Like, we've got to get these conservatives on board. I want to sign something. And then they do it, and then he criticizes it. And then they're doing this, and he's saying, we need to have more heart. And then what's going to happen if they make the bill more liberal and they get it through, then they have to go back and reconcile it with the House. And you're going to have all these conservatives in the House say, this isn't what we agreed to.
There you go.
This
by the way,
what we want.
If I may, Josh, to quote my mother, no one said it'd be easy. Josh, Josh's job not that easy. Josh, of course, is the White House reporter for Politico. Always enjoy having you on, Josh. And it's Politico.com, and the Twitter's at @JDawsey, D-A-W-S-E-Y 1. Thanks for your insight, Josh.
Thanks
for taking time. Absolutely. I'll talk to you next week. We'll talk to you now, 800-222-5222. I do want to talk about the Philando Castile, the new video that's out, and the Michael Brown settlement. I'm also going to give you a chance to win tickets to Kenny Rogers, the Gambler's Last Deal at the Pacific Amphitheater in a moment, or Ann Wilson of Heart at the Grove of Anaheim. I'll tell you when to call. The phone number, 800-222-5222, to participate in the conversation or to get the tickets. And we'll be back, Talk Radio 790 KBC, in just a moment.
Everyone considered him the coward of the
county. Talk Radio 790 KBC, that's, of course, Kenny Rogers. He's on his Gambler's Last Deal tour. Maybe the last time you get to see him. 100 million albums sold, one of the most successful performers in history. He's coming to town, and I got tickets to see him. I also got tickets to see Ann Wilson of Heart. I would call right now if you want to win him. We're going to play the Peter Tilden News Quiz in just a moment. 800-222-5222 is a phone number. But first, let's go to George in Thousand Oaks. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Peter. Just first thing, my deepest sympathies go to the parents that lost their sons in Florida. So there's no judgment call or anything.
Oh, let me just get people up to speed. I talked earlier about these missing Florida teens, and the parents were interrogated. Law enforcement came up to them, talked to the parents, and decided it was, they called it an egregious lapse of judgment and failure to let these kids go out boating by themselves. They had done it many, many times before. I mean, you grew up in Jupiter, Florida. They're 14 years old. They've been on boats a lot. My parents let me go out boating, and they didn't know what I know. They didn't even know if I took courses or stuff, but I would go boating down off the in the ocean. You know, these guys had a 19-foot boat, and the parents are just being taken apart by social media and like I've never seen before, criticized over this trip. So what's your comment on that?
Oh, just that... I grew up in the 60s in Charleston, South Carolina. The Gulf Stream was 75 miles away, so if you wanted to go fishing, that's where you went. I had a roommate from college, from high school going forward, would go out to the Gulf Stream and a Boston Whaler with two or three friends. And I, you know, two or three of the incidents, and this was, he was 18 at the time as a freshman, but a little older. They decided to see if they could trade some beer with the Russian trawler that was 2 miles outside the limit.
No.
He was always trying to pick up a Soviet sub. So I thought it was a great idea. Well, the Russians didn't speak Russian. The other guys didn't speak English. They're trying to horse trade. And the Russians pulled out an AK-47, fired across the bow.
No.
So you know, we laughed about it today, but, you know, stuff happens.
And it does happen. And the other thing is, and it is horrible. It's horrible. And guess who it's horrible for? These parents. And they made a decision and they trusted the kids. But I started wondering, you know, it's so easy to judge and say these are horrible people. How could you do this? How many people today let their kids ride on bicycles? When I left my house in the morning, I said, see you later. We didn't have cell phones. I rode on a bicycle all day everywhere. If my parents knew or saw where I was riding around highways. I went everywhere. But you know what? I figured out how to keep myself safe. And I'm thinking we err sometimes today, many times today, the other way. We're so overprotective of kids. They are just not prepared at all for what they're going to face.
And I did the same thing with a bike. And I got to say, I'll give my stupidity as a kid. We used to have a train that would go through the city and slow down to about maybe 5 miles an hour.
Oh, I think I lost him.
Nope.
Oh, there you go. You're back.
Yeah. Anyway, we would we'd jump on the side of the train and ride it for
sure. You would
for about now that I think about it, if we'd slip, we'd been under the rails. Did we tell our parents? No.
Absolutely. And you know what? I had the parents on because some of the other stories that were mentioned here are the free range parents. These were parents that had their kids, their little kids, 6 and 10. Go to the park by themselves. The park was about a quarter of a mile away from their house. The kids had notes for the police saying, my parents approve this. They know where we are. I'm responsible. I have phone numbers. I have a cell phone. I know not to talk to strangers. And they still had the police pick them up and bring them in, and they were investigated by Child Protective Services. And I had the parents on, both parents, highly educated, highly informed about the area, highly informed about the crime, the low crime rate in their area, because they lived in a pretty upscale neighborhood, and were shocked that they were constantly harassed by people who felt they were doing the wrong thing. And they felt, no, we're preparing our kids for the future. My older kid can watch the younger kid at the park for half an hour. We're not that far. If there's a problem, they can call us. But we want to prepare them for what's coming. So in looking at this pushback, I kind of get people's gut reaction. But if the parents felt that these were accomplished kids in boats and they've done it every day and they love the water, then it's just a tragedy. But I don't, how can you hold a parent responsible for this? They've already paid the worst price. They've lost their children.
They have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, George. I appreciate it. And you know what? I'm glad that you're safe.
Oh, by the way, Peter.
Yeah.
One quick thing, if I may. This weekend out in Camarillo is the annual Greek festival. So I'm sorry, I have to put a plug in. It's one of the best ones around.
Okay. All right.
Join us. If you come out, I'll buy you an ouzo.
You got it. And thank you for the invite, George. You take care.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Oh, you got it in. So real quick before we take a break, not real quick, we have a bit of time, and I see all the lines are lighting up for Kenny Rogers. The video footage that was just released, Minnesota police showed the police officer who fatally shot Philando Castile during a traffic stop last year. It shows that he fired a ton of bullets within seconds of learning that the driver was armed. And it was just, like I said, it was just released yesterday, and there's a big, big uproar about it. Because it appears that the two men, the officer, Mr. Inez, and Mr. Castile, were calm. He greeted Castile and examined his insurance card, and he said, sir, I have to tell you, I have a firearm. And this happened about 30 seconds after they started talking. The cop, as soon as he heard that there was a firearm, he shifted his right hand right onto the holster of his gun, because, I mean, you do a traffic stop and the guy's got a gun. He told Castile not to reach for the gun and pull it out. Castile said he wouldn't, which was repeated by Diamond Reynolds, his girlfriend, sitting in the passenger seat. And he said, I'm not pulling it out. And the officer yelled, don't pull it out. He then unholstered the gun, pushed it in the car, and yelled, don't pull it out. We hear, I'm not. And then about 7 seconds after being informed of the gun, began firing into the car. So it looks horrific. It looks really, it looks pretty simplistic what happened there. And you can judge and go, wow, I can't believe this. I can't believe, and it's part of what we're going through in this whole country about officers using deadly force. But a jury seeing this, seeing other videos, and you remember the girlfriend released a video after the fact. She was talking as her boyfriend was dying in the car and her little daughter was in the back seat. A jury acquitted the officer of manslaughter last week, which created protests in the St. Paul area. And officials said he would not be returning to the police department, but he was also acquitted on two felony charges of endangering Reynolds, who was sitting in the passenger seat with her four-year-old daughter in the back. And you go, how is this possible? I just saw this video. It was taken by a police dashboard camera, which was filming, and it played during the trial. Wasn't publicly released until yesterday. And the recording was revealed in court in the documents. They're not publicly visible in the same way as Reynolds' viral Facebook page. But now the attorney, Glenda Hatchett, is saying what she felt after seeing the dash cam footage is that this is impossible. It's impossible that this guy was acquitted. My question is, since it looks so damning, how is it possible? And I guess because a jury, we're not in the jury trial. We're not hearing every single detail. But I guess what this hinges upon is the officer. And the officer, what would a reasonable officer have seen from his point of view? Remember, we're not standing where he is. We're not looking into the car. We're not seeing what he saw. And apparently he had a good enough explanation from a jury that they bought the fact that he felt his life was in jeopardy. And that, I guess, the level that you have to reach is, again, what would a reasonable officer have seen from his point of view and done? Because here's what happens. We get to see videos, and we get to see them months after they happen, and we discuss them, and we play them, and we slow them down, and we blow them up, and we aren't in that moment. An officer has a nanosecond to react, a nanosecond to decide what's going on there. So we sit and we watch these videos, I guess, out of context, even if they look really, really damning. We weren't in that courtroom. We didn't hear the testimony. We didn't see how it compared the dash cam to her video footage. So he was stopped because he looked like an armed robbery suspect. The dash cam, like I said, is pretty damning. Watching this video looks really, really damning. There's no other way to say it. However, with this trial, I can't imagine that they saw this and thought, oh, yeah, yeah, we're just going to let this officer go, that a jury would decide that. So they had to take into consideration his point of view and the fact that he felt, because this guy had a gun, something was going on there, and he felt this guy was going to pull the gun on him and take his life. So that's the only explanation I can imagine. The judge, the attorney, said I was stunned. The attorney's a former judge who's representing the family. She said to CNN, I was absolutely stunned. I knew in theory what to expect, but we all saw it for the first time. When the jury saw it, I think that it really shows that this cop acted in he's panicked. And his acquittal is now raising questions about this ongoing debate about police accountability and the use of excessive force. And 12 people came to the conclusion to acquit him. And there must be something that they felt, even after seeing this video and talking to the officer, that it was a justified shooting. And now they're looking at the next steps in a civil lawsuit on behalf of Valerie Castile, the mom, and the administrator of his estate, but declined to confirm a report that something has been filed in federal court. So it's insane. Go look at the video for yourself. It's really troubling. Again, it was from the perspective of the cop's dash cam. Just looking at that, you say, wow, this was an assassination. But 12 people who I'm sure tried to do a good job, tried to be discerning, tried to be fair, sat in a courtroom, seeing that, hearing testimony, and all decided that the officer was not guilty and that his life, obviously, he felt he was in jeopardy, and they felt from his POV, from his perspective, he saw something that the video didn't show. And this is the reason that he was acquitted and not charged. Pretty amazing to see this. It's not going to make a lot of people are going to be baffled. And after seeing this, say, how is it possible that a jury could come to this conclusion? It's almost virtually impossible. Love to hear your take on it. We'll do that. We've also got the contest, 800-222-5222. I think we got time for both, a little bit of both, when Peter Tilden at 10 continues right after this. Talk Radio 790 KABC, Peter Tilden at 10. Hour number two continues. That's Ann Wilson of Heart. You can go see her. Or Kenny Rogers, The Gambler's Last Deal, the Pacific Amphitheater. The lines are lit. I'll go to somebody for those tickets in a minute when we play the news quiz. But first, I did want to talk about the video footage showing the traffic stop in Minnesota. And let's go quickly to Bill in Santa Ana. You're on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Good morning.
Hey, Tilden. How you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
I saw that video. And I'm not anti-cop. I have family in law enforcement, friends who were in law enforcement. But this guy shouldn't have gotten off.
So here's my question, Bill, and that's why I brought it up. If you see the video, it's shocking that he got off just from that video. So what I said was there must have been something, a point of view, because you got 12 jurors who decided he was not guilty, and it was a justified shooting. There must have been something that we didn't see that they showed in court that he said during testimony where they bought the fact that he felt that he was in danger or that his point of view, what he saw, is different from the video from his dash cam of what we saw, because there's no other explanation.
Well, one thing that I see that stands out is how could he be in danger? How can Yanez be in danger? The gun was never pointed at him.
Well, here's the deal. Again, Bill. But again, and I'm playing just devil's advocate. I wasn't there, but I brought it up because of this very reason. You watch that video and you go, how is this not an assassination? And they must have heard that this cop felt he was in jeopardy, and he's looking down into the car, and either he saw his hand on the gun, and when you do a traffic stop and the guy's got a gun, you're already at higher alert, and all you need is a movement that made you feel like you're in jeopardy. Why has this guy got his gun out, and what's he doing with it, and why is it on his lap, et cetera? Either that, or you tell me why these jurors would say, okay, you did nothing.
No, that is baffling to me. But in his own words, he said he never saw the gun. I read the transcript.
So then you tell me, what did the jurors see? What did the jurors see? Because I've read a bunch of reports. I watched the video. Of course, we all saw the other video from the girlfriend after the shooting. There's something we're not getting here. So thank you. But thank you very much. Let me go quickly to Art. Art, good morning. You're on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Thanks, Peter.
Sure.
Now, what you have there in Minnesota is you have a special jury. The prosecution went out of their way to get retired police officers. I'm pretty sure there's probably not one African-American on the jury. Probably not.
Well, you know what? I'm going to invest. I got to get more information on this. I'm sure we will hear more information on this because it's fascinating. Fascinating to see how this came down.
I think it's important to remember the state this happened in as well. Minnesota, it's a Confederate 90 flag loving state where average American of European descent is racist.
So you're saying they got a jury of all, they managed to somehow stack the jury that everybody would watch the shooting and ignore it. And
it's been done before, Peter. It's been done many times in this country.
But I'm fascinated with this specific case, Art, because of this video, how they arrived at the decision and what the explanation was. And, Art, thank you very much. You know, I didn't mean to abbreviate. We want to get to the news because we're going to hear more about this. We'll investigate more. And, of course, Dino will reach out tomorrow. If he's even listening, are you listening to me, Dino? No, he's not even listening. He's talking about getting a guest on tomorrow so we can get more information about this. Dino, if you could pay attention. Steve, throw something at Dino and ask him because I'm talking to him. If you could address what I'm talking about. Let's do the news quiz right now. You want to do this? Let's do this real quick. Let's go to Beverly in Antelope Valley. You want to talk Radio 790 KBC? You want to take the quiz?
Yes, I do. Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
All right, so you're ready to win some tickets. You know how to do this. You listen to me carefully. I do multiple choice, true and false, and hopefully you'll win your tickets. Okay, you ready?
I'm ready.
Alibaba CEO Jack Ma said in 30 years, people work how many hours a day? 20 hours a day, 4 hours a day, or 0 hours a day? 20, 4, or 0?
4.
Exactly. So because of artificial intelligence and globalization, we're going to be cut down to 4 hours a day. Is that a good thing? Oh, by the way, I have a lot of friends around here, I think, that are working 4 hours a day right now. All right. What's the latest trend to come to the U.S. from Canada? You ready? Is it A, curling? Is it B, axe-throwing venues? Or C, maple syrup drinks? Curling, axe-throwing venues, or maple syrup drinks?
Therapy.
Yeah, axe throwing. Two recreational axe throwing venues opened this summer, and they're trying to prove that Canadian backyard shenanigans can be popular as bowling and pub darts. And I know in Vegas you can go shoot AK-47s or whatever. Stephen Hawking said that humans should plan to do what? A, meet aliens. B, leave Earth for the moon. Or C, see a new O.J. Simpson reality TV show. Is it meet aliens, go to the moon, or see a new O.J. Simpson reality show?
B.
Yes, Stephen, he calls for a return to the moon as Earth's clock is running out. He, you know what? He's a downer. The man is depressing. He's always saying, we're not going to be living here that much longer. Get to another planet. Boeing, meanwhile, is testing what? A, windowless planes. B, self-flying planes. Or C, bench seating. Is it windowless planes, self-flying planes, or bench seating?
B.
It is. It is. There's self-flying planes. Bench seating, I'm sure some airline is going to be doing that very soon. And George Clooney, we did this earlier. George Clooney just sold his tequila company for what? $100, $500,000, or $1 billion?
$1 billion.
I hate him so much with the pretty wife, and he's got the great teeth, and now he's got $1 billion, and you have got tickets to go see the concert, whether it's Kenny Rogers or Ann Wilson of Heart. You stay on the line, and Kevin will give you your tickets, and thank you for listening, and thank you very much
for playing. Right.
You have a wonderful
thank
rest of your day.
Peter.
Yeah, thank you very much. Enjoy the concert, and everybody else, I'll just hang out here till we do Crosstalk with Dr. Drew next, Talk Radio 790 KBC.